And welcome back to Banter by the Bay with me, DJ Bus Stop. Today we have a special guest, Swanee from the Temple of Swan. We are going to go over some Warriors basketball on this 10-game winning streak. And then we'll go on and talk about the Niners. Do they have a chance to make the playoffs? What do we do with the Harbaugh situation? Right now, it's called the Niners soap opera. And then lastly, we'll go into the hot stove about MLB rumors, what the Giants should do post-Sandoval. All right, so let's start it off with some Warriors talk. Last night, they beat Orlando by 1. Curry had a game-winning 3 with 2.2 seconds left. Then they played awesome defense to end it out. But the game was really awful coming up to the last 4 minutes of the game. What do you think about that game?
Like you said, Curry had a big shot, and they were able to get a big stop towards the end of the game. But they had a great second quarter and then really came out flat in third. And I thought, you know, how are they going to respond coming out in the fourth quarter? And they were able to work their way back. But I think this team has a lot of resiliency, and they can show that they can finish games. And that's huge with Coach Kerr.
Yeah, it's massive. He's got the personality of the team is his personality, the ferocity, the let's win it any way possible. But I think in that third quarter, in the beginning, we were up 12, I think it was. And you just see they're trying to be like the Globetrotters. They were doing, you know, funky passes, you know, kind of behind the back pass, just turning the ball over. And then once that happens, you give the momentum back to the other team. Magic started hitting their shot. Oladipo was on fire all night. You know, Tobias Harris was playing really well, and then O'Quinn had 21 points. So I mean, they didn't have their main center. What was his name?
Vucevic.
Yeah, Vucevic. He usually would play that. I mean, they didn't really miss him because O'Quinn put up the same numbers he would have put up anyways, and O'Quinn would not even really played much at all. But it's just. They gave the momentum back to Orlando. They really became flat. The shooting just was off in the third quarter. I think they shot 28% in the third quarter. That's the lowest this season. And it's amazing when they shoot that badly. Their defense is not as strong because, you know, other teams get so many easy fast break options because you shoot those threes, you get the long rebounds.
Especially with Oladipo. Man, he's an athletic freak.
Wow.
Same with O'Quinn. He's an underrated power forward, athletic. But when you get the Magic, a team that hasn't won a lot of ball games this year, when they hang around against a good team like the Warriors and they start to believe that they can win, it's a bunch of young group there.
Yeah, they're very young. They got Tobias Harris, who's good, and they came off a win
against three.
And they came out. They won against Phoenix the night before, so they were kind of had some momentum. But as Warriors, they did have kind of a disadvantage because there's always a situation where after you go on a long road trip, you come back for the first home game. It's like they've been in three different time zones in 2 weeks, and they come home, and, you know, they rest. They had a day off the next day because they had a two-day break, but they had a day off, and it's just, you know, you're not back yet. You're not back to normal. You're not back to being home. You're not back to being in your regular, you know, work mode, where as you're on the road, it's work completely the whole time. Where at home, you have to deal with family. You have to deal with friends. You have to, you know, deal with your houses, payments, and stuff like so. It's a different situation, and they really came out flat, and I kind of knew they would come out flat. And it's one of those games I think Mark Jackson coaches, and you know, they don't play as spirited, they don't fight until the end like they did last night.
And I think, like you said, that's huge credited to Coach Kerr. And you're right, it's a different mindset. You go on the road and you're just strictly thinking about winning basketball games. You're with your team. You're traveling to different states, and all you can think about is get this W and come back home. Yeah. And they did. And so coming out against the Magic when Curry and Klay were a little banged up, but you kind of expected a slow start. But I thought over time they'd put the Magic away, but they hung around. So that surprised me a little bit.
I think that they really did hang around. But I think the one thing that Orlando showed me when on their offensive side is they have to put a stretch five in. If you put a stretch five in, you move Bogut to the 3-point line, you get him out of that paint, because when he's in that paint, you saw last night, five vicious blocks. All five of them were beautiful blocks and just magnificently timed. He's just so long and lanky, and he got perfect timing, finally healthy, and you can really see the difference, and he's the anchor of this team on defense.
Well, Kirk, all he wanted to do is staple that defense. And you cannot have an outstanding defense without a shot blocker. You have to protect the rim.
Absolutely.
And any time you have a paint protector like Bogut, you're going to have success on defense, and it helps your guards, and out on the perimeter you can get more pressure. But just what you alluded to, when you have a stretch five, all of a sudden that shot blocker is stretched on the perimeter, out on the three-point line, trying to get a hand up. Now you have slashers coming in from all sorts of angles, and he's not there. He's got to guard the stretch five.
Yeah, Channing Frye really put that pressure on him. And when he fouled out late in the fourth quarter, that's when you saw the whole tide
switch.
That was
huge.
Because Okun is not that three-point. I mean, if he's a wing, you know, maybe 18-foot jumper, and, you know, he's able to just be able to get out that far but also be in the paint at the same time. So that was very lucky that he committed an awful sixth foul. Open court, I don't know what he was thinking. But
you scratch your head in that situation. You cannot commit a silly foul like that, and you're gone.
Yeah, but that's why they're 5-14
right.
or something.
Yeah.
That's why. I also saw another stat today that was very interesting about our young Black Falcon, Harrison Barnes. He has 111 rebounds already this year. That's one-third of his total last year.
He's crashing the glass.
He's averaging 8.5 rebounds a game.
I think that's part of a role that Steve Kerr said, hey, we need you to crash the glass here. Let's have this be a big staple in your game.
Yeah, that's so important. I mean, because early in the season, the Warriors were awful rebounding. The first 2 weeks, they were awful. And I think, and that's when his totals were really down. And I think Kerr was like, how are you going to make our team better? We have scoring on our first team. We have defense on our first team. You can be part of the great defense, but we need you to come back and clear the boards after Bogut is coming in and trying to make the shot block. We have Clay putting pressure on, where Curry's putting pressure on, trying to leak out for early release offense. So it's just he came up, and he's so athletic. You don't really see it that much, but every once in a while, just spark, he'll jump, get the ball 2 feet over the rim. It's just amazing how athletic and how much he can jump.
And you can't coach that. But we see this throughout all championship teams. Every player has a role defined. When roles are not defined, and that's got to do with the head coach, you see Popovich, he's got everyone on the Spurs with that specific role defined. And now, so do the Warriors. And like you just said with Barnes, how he's crashing the glass so hard, that's his role.
Yeah, there's some,
Iggy has his role. Yeah, Clay and Curry have theirs. Bogut has his.
Yes. And then you even got to go to the bench. You got Mo Spates. He's got his role. He's got, you know, score as many points as you can with that second team, because right now we don't have much scoring on that second team. You got Sean Livingston, be the leader of that second team, you know, be the ball handler, be the, you know, drive and dish player. You know, he's shooting that 15-foot turnaround nicely.
That's the first time in his career I think he's had confidence to shoot that.
Yeah, it's great. It expands his game, because now the guard has to come pressure, and you got those lanes coming. So then you got so many different aspects, and, you know, Barbosa's playing all right now. I think he's still kind of hurt a little bit, not playing at full strength. Brandon Rush is, you know, fine. He can be at the end of our bench. But when David Lee comes back, now we have a situation. Our situation is, does Mo Spates become our third center, and then where do you put Festus Ezeli? He's our fourth center. Is this? It's like, what do you do?
You're
there?
Crowded in the front court.
Yeah, and I mean, you can put in, you know, I guess Mo would be the backup to the center, and I guess D. Lee would be backup to Draymond. But it's just, you got those two players are too similar and to play in the same situational, because they're both not very good defensively. Mo Spates is a little bit better now, but David Lee is not a good defensive player, and that's what always has been his kind of downfall, and we've seen it.
So how do you weave him in there?
I think we have to weave him in there. Is we start him off. First of all, he's out for another week. They came out today and said that he was out for another week, which is great. The more time to get better, be 100%.
Right.
We don't need you at 90%. We're 110 straight without you. I mean, right now it's a pretty easy schedule for the next 5 to 7 more games. I mean, we have the Bulls, probably our next hardest matchup, and then on December 18th is the Thunder, and that's our big matchup in, you know, KD and Westbrook will
be
back.
Dandy.
That'll be my sister will be going to that. But it's you have to bring him back slowly. 10 minutes a game with the second squad. He's just going to put up big points in the second teams. You know, there's no two second team power forward that can guard him. There's not many first team power forwards that can guard him. And so you put him there and you score 10, 12 points in the 10 minutes. Boom, you know, we got our second team scoring for that night out of him, you know. It's just points. That's what we need in the second team. That's what we need in our rotation, is we need some point scorer, and I think he fills that role perfectly.
So if he succeeds in that role and he's filling up buckets in that second team, does he stay there? Or do you have to get him back in the starting lineup?
Well, that's the issue. Now, Kerr, if both of them are playing outstanding, and the only thing is, when you come to the playoffs, there's one thing that helps you win it all, and that's defense. And the most important thing, I think, our team is defining itself as is being a defensive-minded team. And being a defensive-minded team is just thinking about your defense first and then running that defense from that defense, using it as offense. So I think Draymond Green adds the aspect of being a starting four guard in almost any team around the league right now.
He's fearless.
He is fearless.
That's what you want.
It's just smarts, right? It's just all basketball IQ. I mean, people say it's just not a cliche. It's a real thing. It's, you know, he knows the plays. He knows angles. He knows, you know, situations when to double team. There's times when players just play the game. You know, you see players just play the game. You know, a JaVale McGee, that he doesn't think about what he does. He just reacts. His body reacts. A lot of players are reactionary. He's more cerebral, where he just thinks about the way the game is being played and what plays should be made at that time.
And since he is so intelligent, you see him, as big as he is, he can move his feet and defend the perimeter. David Lee can't do that if he gets extended
out. Absolutely not. And if there's any stretch fours, David Lee gets burnt because he does not guard the three-point line. But you're right, Draymond Green, it's all technique. It's, you know, the angles of shuffling your feet, you know, breaking down the defense, getting low, you know, get when to reach in, when not to. And he's just a great player, and he's going to get a big contract because he deserves it. He truly does.
That's a good topic right there. There's going to be a lot of teams wanting Draymond Green. How bad did the Warriors try to re-sign him?
So I was listening to Bob Myers on the radio the other day, and Joe Lacob was on at the same time, and they were talking about this. They were talking about, you know, they're probably going to extend Curry in the offseason because he's coming up on his last year, and we have him for $11 million. His deal was a four-year, $44 million deal, which is absolutely ridiculous. That's the same deal Ty Lawson's getting, and I think we have the best point guard in the league.
Oh, absolutely.
So, I mean, yeah, and also there's also a factor is that the NBA Players Association and the owners just signed a new deal for a $300 billion TV rights. So each team is now dividing that up, right? Or $300 million. So they're dividing up. So each team is getting an extra $30 million added to their salary cap. So now you're going to see the bonus or the max contracts go up to, like, it used to be like 17 to 22, depends on where you are in the tax situation. But now you're going to see 25 to 27. And that's what Curry's going to get. He's going to get max, and that's fine. And then we're going to pay Draymond. They came out and they said we're going to pay him. And they said we'll go into the luxury tax. That's fine because we're winning so much. We've sold out 86 straight games, right?
And when you're successful like that, you're not worried about going into the luxury tax. If you're not winning, then you have other problems.
Yeah, then it's big issues. But then another issue is if you're in the luxury tax 2 years in a row, there's a repeater fine, which is double of that luxury tax. And that's where, like, the Brooklyn Nets are looking at and stuff. So I think that we'll be able to – in 2 years, you have to look down the road. You have to look Iggy. You have to look at D-Lee's two contracts, right? Because those are two heavy, heavy contracts. Because D-Lee's almost getting max, and Iggy's getting, like, 15 or something like that. So those are huge contracts. You definitely have to look back in the future. But, you know – It's to come.
It's in the future. You got time.
So what do you think about their championship odds? Did you see on the
power rankings?
Power rankings is number one, but the odds came out in Vegas today. They're 1/8 to win it all. Right.
I like it. I like
that. They're third behind the Cavs, were number one, and the Spurs are number two. What do you think about that?
Vegas loves to play that role of hyping up. I don't want to say they hyped up the Heat, and in the first year they didn't win it. And I know they're hyping up the Cavs, and you'll see the Cavs compete, and they'll get in the playoffs and they'll do damage. But I would bet my bottom dollar that they don't win the championship this year. So I'd say it's coming down to the Warriors and the Spurs. Who's ever coming out of the West can take it again.
I agree.
And so I think that's an accurate statement. Vegas comes out 1/8 to win the championship, but it's all about how you're playing in the latter half of the season. If they start clicking with D. Lee, we've seen them succeed already without no Lee. If they come back and fill him in and they start dominating, then the Spurs have some serious competition to go with in the playoffs, especially if the Warriors can own home court.
Yeah, and I agree. I think there's going to be a fun ride coming up. And I was hearing some debates today. I mean, if the season ended today, who would be the MVP? And, you know, there's a couple options out there. There's Curry, right? There's Marcus Gasol, who's having a
maybe Anthony Davis.
Anthony Davis. So what's your opinion on that?
I'm saying right now it's between Anthony Davis and Steph Curry. But how great of a story would it be for Curry to be the first MVP in Dubs history?
Oh, that'd be amazing.
I think that'd be an amazing story. And right now he's playing like he deserves it. Mm-hmm. And so look at the record. You always got to look what team you're playing for and how much of an impact you're doing for that team. And Curry right now is doing a lot more for the Warriors than Davis. Even though he's stat stuffing, Pelicans aren't where the Warriors are.
You have to look at the team and how the team is developed around. And we have this is the first time I can say in my time being a Warriors fan is that we have a superstar. We have a superstar that can take us to a championship. And that's a crazy, crazy idea, you know. It's like, oh, my God, we can do it. We can get to the conference finals. We can get by the first round. Hopefully, if OKC is not sitting at 6 and we're sitting at 3 or something like that.
That's the brutal story. If you claim a 1 or 2 seed and OKC is sitting at 7 or 8, are you kidding me? That's the worst possible matchup. You work your tail off to earn that caliber of a seed, and you got to play possibly one of the best teams in the NBA when healthy.
Jesus.
In the first round? Are you kidding me?
I know. The West is a crazy.
That's a gauntlet.
I think you got to win 51 or 52 games.
That's accurate.
So I also heard Bob Fitzpatrick talking about this on the radio. He was talking about, and the NBA owners, they came in, they talked together, and one thing they discussed about in the offseason was changing the playoff format to be every conference winner or every divisional winner gets in, and then picking the next top best 10 teams after that. So it would be probably 4 teams from the East and then 12 teams from the West, or, you know what I mean, like 5 teams and 11. So it's like a – it's like the best of the best. Because it's not fair, Phoenix winning 48 last year, and then what, Wizards getting in with a 38 wins or something like that. It's just crazy.
I don't have a problem with that. I'm okay with that format. Because if the East continues this struggle of where your 8th seed is under 500 and your 7th seed is at 500, and then you have a team in the West not getting in that's 13 or 14 games above, 10 games above 500, doesn't make any sense at all, especially when you play the majority of your games against Western Conference competition.
Yeah, I know. It's like they play harder teams.
And you have a better record.
It's unbelievable.
But you don't get in.
You don't get in.
Are you in favor of that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And it was brought up and it was laughed out the door by the owners because the owners are breaking news. Nick Markakis goes to the Braves. Dang, I really wanted him to go to the Giants. But let's
we'll
go back.
That.
Yeah, we'll get into that. But
playoff format?
Oh, yeah, the playoff format. There we go. I was reading my text and I forgot. The playoff format, yeah. Because even if the East, I mean, see, 10 years down the road and the East becomes the dominant conference, right? Then you still have the fair. Then the East can have the more. It's not like a realignment that Mark Cuban was talking about, you know, all the Texas team moving to the East and then like Detroit, Milwaukee, all those teams moving to the West.
That was drastic. And what Cuban tried to come out with.
Yeah, it's anything Mark Cuban does is a very, very drastic. All right, we'll be back. We're going to take a quick break and then we'll go into some Niners talk. It might be a little depressing, but we got to do it.
We got to do it.
All right, we'll be back in a few.
just to feel so uninspired. And when I knew I had to face another day, Lord, it made me feel so tired. Before the day I met you, life was so unkind, and you're the key to
ready to talk about the Niners. The Niners. Like I called it before, it's the soap opera.
It's a good term right there, the soap opera. Oh,
God, it's just awful. You just hear so much negative publicity going on and on. Let's start about last week. Let's talk about how we lost that game so badly. First thing is, our offense just could not do anything. Our running backs didn't hit the right holes. Our offensive linemen were missing blocks that usually is, you know, this Seattle team is not that outstanding of a defensive team right now. I have them on my fantasy team, and I can tell you from their points, they are not that good right now.
This is what's so frustrating from a Niners fan, as we both are. We see other teams have success against this defense. In our five losses, they have completely shut our run game down. The only time we had success was in that NFC Championship game where Cap went off. Gore has never had success. We couldn't get Hyde going. We can't run the ball against them. So every time they come in and we play the Seattle Seahawks, what are the Niners going to do differently? Can they throw the ball? And they haven't been able to do that any time that they've played the Seahawks. So what's the game plan? How are you going to beat this team? What's the formula?
I don't know. I mean, I was thinking, oh, let's run it like a hurry-up offense, quick offense, run to the line. But Kaepernick's not smart enough
to
run that.
They can't do that, yeah.
The plays don't come in quick enough, it's just such a deterrent for us because with such an athletic quarterback, that's what you want him to do. You want him to come up to play and make those calls. You want him to be, a Russell Wilson, run the ball, run the play, get up to the line, let's go. You make that defense tired. We sit there for all, 25 seconds of the clock, wait down 1 second, have all these false motions that really don't really mean much, and then they run the clock, and these defenses know what's coming because we're really, really obvious. I mean,
we're blatant.
When you run the same offense for the last 4 years, it's obvious. This is the same offense Alex Smith was running. There's no difference. There's really no difference because how many times you see him, Kaepernick, unleash a bomb 3-4 times a game. That's what Alex Smith maybe did. He threw it 2-3 times, and that's because he didn't have the ability. Kaepernick has this ability to throw the ball down the field, yet we still don't use it. He has the ability to escape the pocket and run, but yet we don't use it. We're afraid of him getting hurt, and that's not how you can live and play in the NFL.
And it seems like, okay, the Niners are conservative with Cap running the ball, and then once they get into the playoffs, okay, we unleash him. Go, you can go run. And it had worked, but now we are not in that situation where the playoffs are looking likely. It's a possibility if they run the table the rest of the season. But like you said, with the hurry-up offense, it almost is like Cap, he can't function when he does that. He can't read a defense quick enough or orchestrate an up-tempo offense to where he's getting the plays and he's executing, he's snapping the ball within 10 seconds. And I think that would be great for a change of pace if the Niners could do that. If they threw it in a lot, that could help establish your running game. And if you don't establish your running game, we've seen the Niners look awful on offense.
I mean, this game just showed it. When Kaepernick was throwing the ball 3 feet to the left, 3 feet to the right, up, down, everywhere but the receiver. The two times he threw the picks to Sherman, it was like the easiest, it was just like a plain catch.
Yeah,
it was just ridiculous. But I think there's an aspect of Kaepernick that everyone always overlooks. I think everyone calls him out for only looking at his first option and not progressing through his read. I think it's the pre-snap determination of what he's going to do. I think he sees the defense, which he's probably guessing wrong on anyways. That's why his playing is one read and head down and let's go. Or head down and hit the ground before even a real lineman is coming near me. Or feel some pressure, not step up, but go backwards where you have no lineman instead of step up where your linemen are supposed to be protecting you. But that pre-snap read of, what is this defense going to do? I mean, you know, the best do it. The greats do it,
I love how you brought that up.
Russell Wilson does it, And what does that come from? That comes from studying and watching film, not working out, not practicing your throws. I don't care if you can make all the throws. If you can read the defense and you can pick the right receivers, you're going to be a decent quarterback. There's some players that just don't have great arms. Just some that just don't. I mean, Drew Brees has a great arm, but it's not phenomenal. It's not phenomenal. It's not an Aaron Rodgers arm. I mean, Tom Brady had an unbelievable arm in his early career, but his arm is not as what it used to be. Even Peyton Manning now, it's just they find the open receivers because they know how to read a defense.
You just listed some greats. How many of those quarterbacks make checks at the line? I'd say all of them make at least one hot route or check at the line of scrimmage every single play. Every single play, because there's an adjustment that the defense has made, and then the quarterback sees it, and he calls it out. He communicates that to the offense. What you said of studying film, I don't know if Cap's not doing that enough or if he just can't read a defense yet because he's new in the league, but that excuse is starting to get old.
I had 4 years.
Yeah, and so what is it? Why can't he make those checks? What is he not seeing that all these other great quarterbacks are seeing? Because the talent is there. But what defenses fear so much is all these checks at the line that Rodgers and Manning and Breeze and Brady are making at the line. Even Luck, we see a lot of adjustments now. And this is his second year. And so we look at Kaepernick and we look at the offense struggling, and there are no pre-snap reads that are accurate.
No, they're predetermined pre-snap reads. They're okay. So if you see two guys in the safety area, go to the run. So he'll go kill, kill, kill. But that's not him realizing that, okay, I just called kill, 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 but now one of the safeties is moving up.
That's just changing the play to a different play that they got. They give him two plays,
It's not really any audible. It's more of a okay, we're going in with two plays. I'm going to look at the defense, how they set up originally, and I'm going to make that change. But then it's going to be a 10-second play because you got two different motions. You got to look off. You got to make some fake calls. It's
almost compensating for Cap because he cannot read a defense. They try this blur motion that defenses aren't biting on that. And so you hear Manning yell, Omaha, and you hear Rodgers, he's yelling, Jerry, like a bunch of these random names. We don't know what they mean. We don't know if they could be fake, but when they make those pre-snap hot routes, it's working.
Yeah, it makes the defense think, right? It makes them think, okay, there's something, he's changing something. Maybe we're not running the right defense, or maybe we were, but now he changed it to another play. And you're thinking, oh, dang, what's going on?
And everybody knows inside that quarterback's head, he knows what the defense is running. That's why he's calling this. Yeah. Or that's why he's bluffing. He knows what they're in. Cap doesn't know that. And so they've been successful with Kaepernick. It's been the turmoil and the soap opera within the Niners organization that has really hurt. And I think the off season, that was a shamble. And it kind of carried over.
I think you have the
injuries too. So yeah. you have a long list of Niner problems.
I think, you know, I hate doing this. My friends hate when I do this, but I have to do this. I got to compare them to the Jets of a couple years ago, right? You compare them two AFC championships in a row. You know, maybe we did one more year. But again, they were on the back of their defense. We were using – our defense was at its prime. We were holding people to 17 points a game, causing so many turnovers, putting our offense in great situation to kick field goals like we did all last year. But it's you're not going to win it. You're not going to win it without an offense. You're not going to win it without a quarterback that makes heads-up plays. You know, there are a very few quarterbacks that have won it that have not been the top 10 in passer rater, and that's, you know, last year was Russell Wilson. A couple years ago was Trent Dilfer. But what are those two players? They're so cerebral. They make the right plays. They do not make wrong plays. And it's just Cap wants to make the impressive play, not the right play. He wants to make it last in the pocket. He wants to scramble around, lose 5 yards, 6 yards when he gets sacked instead of looking, you know, seeing really nothing's open and throw it away. He just doesn't do that.
So where does he go with these last games down the stretch? How do the Niners rally and somehow try to get a playoff berth?
I mean, you have to win out. You have to look flawless. You have to somehow... I don't know.
Is it just too much of an exaggeration to imagine that
I think it's too much of an exaggeration. I think, you know, I was talking to you about this earlier about how Jed York's probably wanting the Oakland Raiders to win because then it'll make it easy for the Jim Harbaugh firing, which... Oh, it's frustrating because he's just, everyone loves him, and he's such a great coach to the public, to the players. But there's an aspect of sports that I think people really misunderstand is that he's an employee of Jed York. I mean, Trent Baalke is an employee. I mean, if you were working at a company and you were talking to your boss and you were disrespecting your boss, but you still had high performance, I think your boss's attitude towards you is the most important thing. And if there's a conflict between that, there's going to be poor reflection in your work and poor reflection on the boss. So this is what Jed York is thinking. I think Jed York is going to be cleaning house, getting rid of Roman, getting rid of Harbaugh. And then you see all of these other coaches, assistant coaches, now politicking to become head coach. And it's just, it's a very, very hard situation because, well, you know, Harbaugh's still on that one more year after this. You know, do we let him walk and pay him that $5 million? Or he said he'll not let us trade, but I think that's probably the best situation.
For the Niners, yeah, that would probably be the best situation. Overall, it's sad as a Niner fan because they were on the cusp 3 years in a row, NFC Championship back-to-back-to-back years. This coaching staff, this team, this organization was on fire. They were clicking. And now we have one down year. And we all start to see how much problem Jed York had with Jim Harbaugh. It's been brought to the forefront. And I think when you're winning, all that is under the rug. It doesn't matter. You're winning. The team is winning. That's all that matters, money-wise, fan-wise, everything. And so now when it struggles, all of this, boom, has blown up. And I don't think it's just in the organization. It might be going on with his coaching staff, too, that I don't know how much they like Jim Harbaugh. And it's too bad because he was successful. He changed this culture around, and they won. And they were winning back-to-back-to-back seasons. And so one down year, it feels like the train is going to derail. Yeah. They can see the end of that mountain, and it's not good.
No, I agree with you 100%. I mean, I think that NFL teams have – good teams have a lifespan of 5 years, right? You look at the Eagles back when they had T.O. and McNabb. They went to 3 straight NFC championships. That was a 5-year span of where they got into playoffs and, you know, they kind of flared out in the 5th year. Then you go to the Jets. They had a good 4 years. Then you go to other teams. You go to the Pittsburgh Steelers when they won the 2. They had a good 5 years, but they never were exactly what they were after Tomlin won his first. So I think, you know – after those 5 years, and if you don't get it, people know you. Now they know everything about you because you've done that 5-year plan, 5 years of, you know, how the team has been developed and worked, and now your players are kind of getting old or taken away because they become so good. Other teams now desire them. So now this 5 years, I think you just need to blow it up and start over.
That's a great point.
I'm sorry. I know I'm diehard Niners fan, and it's going to be hard to go through some loss, but I think we have enough talent on our team that our next five-year period could be quick, you know. But the situation now is if Harbaugh goes, does Kaepernick go with him?
That would be disastrous because right now it looks like they're not going to bring back Crabtree.
Yeah, that definitely doesn't look there's good. No chance.
We have Upati up in the air. You need to keep the offensive line has not looked that great this year, and they've been dominant in the past. So that's worrisome. But I still think Upati is a Pro Bowl guard. And so you have Bolden getting old. You have your defense to lean on, which helps.
A young defense to lean on. A lot of rookies.
So what you're saying is if Harbaugh is gone and how close Kaepernick and Harbaugh are, that'd be very devastating for the Niners to see that happen. But that's how his contract was set up.
Oh, yeah, it's perfect.
Pay as you go.
Oh, yeah, $12.5 million is the only guarantee we owe him, and we already paid him that. We can literally cut him tomorrow and not pay him a single dollar.
And so there's huge controversy to come this offseason. But if somehow the Niners find a way, which it just doesn't look like it could happen because they cannot find any way to win in Seattle. That Seattle's had their number. And so they might be out. But if they do, I'm going to be optimistic. If they do get in, what happens?
They have to win it all. They have to win it all or he's gone.
Or he's gone? Oh, yeah. Win it all or gone, even if they get in.
Win it all or gone. It's like the Mark Jackson of last year. Win it all, get to the conference championship. Him was the winning it all was getting conference to the conference championship. Get it all, win it all, or get to college championship, and he's fine. But nope. And the Warriors did it perfectly. You know, everyone loved Mark Jackson. The fans loved Mark Jackson. I didn't personally love Mark Jackson. A little too religious for me. But then the players, you know, stood by his side when they were looking for the new coach. now I don't think anybody is complaining. I think that you had the basis of a team like the Niners do. We have a shell of a team. We have, there's a few pieces we need here, we need there. There's a new offense we need to completely reconstruct. We can reconstruct an offense with our already existing players. That's why I don't think it's such a project as, whereas like a taking over team like Tennessee or the Jets as of now. I think we have such a strong shell and core players. Like, you know, Patrick's going to get old in a couple years. I mean, Navarro's still young. You got Borland going to fill right in there. You know, you got Dante Johnson, a nice cornerback on the outside. You know, you got Eric Reed for a while. You got all these, Aaron Lynch on the outside. It's just a great group of young athletes, young defensive players. And that's where you win championships, on defense. So I think we have a great core. We just need a whole new offense. And that's Jim Harbaugh and Greg Roman. They are there to run the offense, and Jim doesn't even talk about the defense.
And so who do you look to bring in? Who's an offensive guru that you could bring in? Because you have the defense, and I think that is a great mindset of how good the Niners draft.
Yeah, oh, that's why Trent Baalke's dead. That's why Trent Baalke is great. He's not a great offensive drafter. He really, really misses on some offensive players, really does.
AJ Jenkins.
I mean, oh God, I don't even want to talk about it. But it's just amazing how great of a linebacker drafter he is. I mean, look at who he's drafting. Navarro.
That's true.
No, he wasn't there for Navarro, but I mean, Aaron Lynch, Alden Smith, just freaks, man. I think our defense is set to be good for a long time.
Is there anybody that we could get in to shape up the offense?
Kyle Shanahan, I think, would be a great offensive coordinator. I think he is more, you know, unique, and I think he's more of an aggressive play caller. I really like he's the coordinator for the Ravens right now, Gary Kubiak. He's a great offensive mind. He definitely could work come in there.
What about Tressman from the Bears?
Tressman, I think he would be a coordinator.
Spread?
He'd be. Oh. I would. I mean, why not have a spread offense? Why not? It would work so well. I mean, we have such great possession receivers. That's what a spread offense could use. And we have Bruce Ellington. It's just sad how we never utilize any of our speed ever. Never. You know, put them in. Let them run a streak. Let them run a post. Let them run a deep corner route. Let them just stretch the field. You know, because Brandon Lloyd's not going to stretch the field at his old age. Crabtree's not going to spread the field. Bolden is, so... That's kind of the situation I see right now.
You know what hurt the Niners? Is their offense got way too complex. Compared to what Seattle runs, they run 8 plays.
Yeah, seriously.
They have the read option, you give it or you keep it, and they implement a bubble screen or they have a guy going deep. That's what their core offense is built around. They won a championship last year doing that. And so, and with a great defense, obviously.
Oh, great defense.
But
yeah.
Now the Niners' offense have gotten way too complex. And I think it's way over the head of Kaepernick, and they try to use too many of their weapons when you need to simplify things, but it's too late for that now. You're too deep.
I agree. And in the play calling, you know, I think the play calling is from Greg Roman. It gets sent down to Jim Harbaugh. Jim Harbaugh takes a couple seconds, good five seconds.
Do I like it?
Do I like it? In what situation? He looks over his play sheet and then says, okay, we'll go with this, and then send it into Cap. Or then he goes, nah, I'll pick another one. Takes another couple seconds. So then the time is just running. And everyone's sitting there. You see Kaepernick kind of just waiting, bouncing his head, you know, kind of faking, looking at his wristband. And you're just like, you're kidding. You're kidding.
That's the whole process of what the Niners do to get in the play call.
Yeah, and it's frustrating. It's real frustrating. So what do we do with Jim? He's obviously, he doesn't want to be here because – you know, those last couple comments he made in his press conference, like, I mean, I would love to trade him. I would love to get a first,
That's
second.
That's the best case scenario.
Yeah, get a first round pick.
Anything. First through third round.
Yeah.
I'm fine with.
Yeah.
For a coach? Are you kidding me? I'll take that.
Yeah, I think the Raiders would be suckers enough to take that.
That's but will he block the trade? That's what he's talking about.
You know what? If it's to the Raiders, I have a feeling he's not going to because it's just such a great opportunity for him. All right. You know, I don't have to move houses. I can move. I can go literally work 25 miles away from where I used to work.
But will he be miserable?
Well, I also think he could also spearhead the move to L.A. and become, you know, the head coach of the L.A. Raiders. And, you know, and that would be a huge franchise. I mean, especially right now with the social media aspect of sports is that L.A. team is a must, because back in the day, I understand when LA's don't have, I mean, the coverage, you know, LA sports news, everything was at, it was definitely in a minimal compared to what it is now, where it's just Twitter, you got everything that just blows everything up all the time. I mean, and everything is in LA, sports centers in LA, you know, you got the Lakers in LA. So I think it's a great opportunity, but you know, maybe that's just me being in my own head.
If the Raiders don't get anything moving fast, they will be out of town. If not, the state could go to Texas.
They could go to Texas.
I don't know if that's probable, but
I hope not.
That would be something Harbaugh, if he ended up with the Raiders, that could be something he would like to do.
It's like something he could spearhead. Like, you know, this whole stadium was him building it because of his good teams. That's a bunch of hooey doing.
Quick question. Santa Clara, first year the Niners have played here. How is it compared, them playing in Santa Clara, to when they used to play in Candlestick?
Candlestick was so much louder, as sad as that is to say. I mean, you go in after the second half, it's if it's hot, too hot, or if it's raining, those people in the club section are just sitting in their area watching on the TVs and eating gluttonously. And so you have your real loud aspect of a stadium comes from the middle part. It doesn't come from the top. Like, it just disperses up. It really starts down at the core. And when that's gone and you see all these empty seats, it's like, and all the players see these empty seats, it's like, what? It's not a home field advantage.
This is what ticks me off. Seattle comes and plays us. Russell Wilson has no problem. This was supposed to be a packed house. He has no problem making checks at the line. When we go to Seattle, Kaepernick can barely communicate with the wide receivers, let alone the offensive linemen, if he's changing a play. That's how loud it is in the 12th man. I understand that's how they built their stadium, but our stadium is pathetic, crowd noise-wise, compared to that. It looks beautiful, but you want a little bit of an edge.
Yeah, I agree with you, but it's also hard on a holiday at 5:30. I mean, if it would be cool if it'd be at like a 1 o'clock game, because then people can go home afterwards and eat Thanksgiving. But it's right in the middle of Thanksgiving, you know. Nobody really. I had tickets and I didn't want to go. It's not a, you know, it's a family day. You have to do what you have to do.
What'd you do with those tickets? Because I would have gone.
We try to sell them. We literally try to sell them to the last second, and no one would buy them. We put them less than face value. That's how many tickets were available. There was thousands of tickets available for this game.
Man, that's disappointing.
It is disappointing, but you know what? The Niners haven't proven anything to anybody this year.
Right.
And it's sad. I mean, you have, especially in your inaugural year at your stadium, like, look at what the Giants did when they moved into 2000 into the new Pac Bell Park, and they played unbelievable, won 90 games, went into the playoffs. It's like, yes, that's what you're supposed to do. But not lose. We've only won twice there. We're 2-3 at home. Are you kidding me?
We lost our opening ceremonial game to the Bears in the worst fashion. And now that loss is going to come back and haunt us.
And then the St. Louis loss.
Right.
I think that was at home, wasn't it?
Right, yeah. Yeah. Just happened a couple weeks ago.
It's like, are you kidding? What's going on?
That's terrible.
I can't talk about this anymore. It's hurting my soul. We're going to the break. And when we come back, we'll talk about some hot stove, some Giants baseball.
I want you to stay with me. I need your mama's eyes. Don't let go nowhere. Let me give you one. Let me give you one.
Thank you. give you all. Lady in my life now. Let me be your babe. All over, all over, all over.
Hello, and we're back, and let's talk about some hot stove. Like I brought up earlier, Nick Markakis, he's a third outfielder for the Orioles. He signed a four-year, $44 million contract.
Braves got a nice player there.
Yeah, I mean, that means Justin Upton is gone, 100%.
Yeah.
So now do the Giants go after Justin Upton?
I hope so, man. He's got a lot of potential. Especially being a young outfielder, when he was with the Diamondbacks, we talked about this off air, punished the Giants.
Punished.
And so he comes back to the NL West specifically. I think he could do some work, and that'd be a nice outfielder to get because he's got an arm too.
He does. I agree. It would be very, very, very nice, but it would be a trade, and what are we willing to give up? And
that's very true.
That's the interesting part.
You've got to dip into the prospects. Giants don't like doing that.
I agree. But also, I don't want to sign a Lester or a Scherzer for a 7-year, 6-year, $140 million contract because that would just blow our bank and that'd be the Zito situation all over again.
I think they know that. I don't think they're going to sign either. Even though it would be awesome momentarily.
For 2 years.
2 or 3 years, right. But anything longer than that, there goes the decline. Giants fans complain. They reminisce about, oh, this is Zito all over again. I don't think the Giants will do that, even though short-term, Bumgarner and Scherzer, dude, that's a dirty 1-2 punch.
I know. I agree.
Short-term, though.
But, yeah, I know. But we just got to wait. I mean, we had that first-round pick drafted from Vanderbilt last year, Beattie. He's going to, you know, hopefully be up in the
AAA.
He showed great promise. You know, so it's, you know, we have prospects coming up. Do we want to get rid of them? I think if we want to get rid of prospects, we have to go for an outfielder. We have to go for a left fielder or re-sign Morse and then go make a trade for a third baseman. You need somebody like Cespedes or Justin Upton because you need a six-hitter. That's what we're looking for right now. We're losing a six-hitter in Pablo, a 5-6-hitter in Pablo. So
my question to you is, if you're going after a Cespedes or Justin Upton, do you think the Giants are willing to give up Gary Brown?
Yeah, I don't think.
You think he's done?
I don't think
that project's done.
Yeah, I don't think Gary Brown is worth going to be worth anything.
Neither do I. But is there upside in the Giants' minds?
I don't care. We just won 3 World Series without him. You know, get rid of him. I don't know where we just signed Hunter Pence to a 5-year contract.
That was one of the best contracts I've ever seen.
Yeah, great. And then we got Pagan for another couple years. I think we have 2 more years after this. And then we're going to sign a left fielder for a couple years. So where does he fit into that? So it's, you know, does he have to wait 2 more years again? He's kind of getting older. He's like 25 already up there.
I'm with you. I say deal him.
Deal him. And then,
get him out of here.
You know, deal Embry. I'm kind of sick of waiting for Embry. You know, I think what we've done out of our farm system is we find people deeper than AAA. We go in, if you look back 2 years ago, we got Crawford, who was coming out of AA. And then this year, we got Panic, who came out of AA. You got Belt, who played at AA mostly and really skipped AAA and came up. So you look at this, and it's funny because, you know, people say, oh, your farm system is no good. You know, I mean,
not anymore.
I mean, people, no, it was never, you know,
we got RiverCats now.
Yeah, that's true. RiverCats now. But our AAA, your Sacramento RiverCats, your AAA, people usually only look at your AAA and really rate you off that. But it's really, we don't look to AAA. Our AAA is kind of like, you know, have people going back and forth, a Blanco or a Perez or something like that. But when you got Panics and Crawford's coming up through the AA system, you know, I think that's why you can really, we have the ability to really sell off any of those prospects.
I think Panic was one of the most key players in that playoff run.
Oh, yeah.
Without defensively and some timely hitting, we see the Giants have clutch second base play in their World Series runs, and we get it from Panic.
Yeah.
You don't think it would be that of an important role, but they're huge.
Oh, it's one of the most important plays was that backhand up the middle that flipped a second. Oh my God, he's just nasty. I mean, you don't need a great hitting second baseman. Second baseman, you don't need the Jeff Kents or, you know, the Dan Uggles back in the day. You just need the let's hit the ball to left field. Let's hit the ball to right field. If there's a person on first, let's move him over. That's all you need in great defense, and there you go. You have a perfect second baseman. Stick him in this two-hole. No one will have issues, and you will make money.
So you have Belt at first, Panic second, Crawford short. That's cemented in. Nobody at third now with Panda gone. Do you go after and get Chase Headley?
I think no. I don't know what we're going to do. I think we're going to platoon there with Arias and – I know it's going to kill you.
We tried the platooning in left field.
But outfielders different for this reason why. Outfielders are supposed to be your power hitters. Infielders are not your strength.
Was our power hitter.
I know, but that's because we lacked a power hitter really all in outfield. Somebody was always gone in the outfield, you know. Pagan was gone or Morse was gone for a while. I think, yeah, I don't know. There's no third basemans out there that I want.
So you're saying you have to dial in and get a left fielder?
Yeah.
If we do that, then I'm okay platooning it.
We have to either get Cespedes or Upton. I think those are the two key guys, and I think you need to make a move if you want to be, because we're not a power hitting team, but we need that length in our lineup. Length is very important. Where everyone in your one through probably seven can really drive in a run. That's what you need. At least drive in 60 one through six. So if you have a Cespedes, I think that can happen. He can fit into that category. Or Justin Upton, he can fit into that category. But if they exceed what we expect them to do, because Michael Morse really did nothing for us this year. I mean, if you look at it, he hit that one big home run off Nishak, and that was about it. Because he only hit 13 home runs this season, and 12 of them were before the All-Star break.
He started out great.
Oh, yeah.
And then the typical Michael Morse showed.
Come on, man. He's on pace to hit 35 home runs, and he hit 13. I
was hoping at least 20.
When was the last time the Giants had a 21 home run hitter? I was trying to think about that the other day. Barry? That's the last one.
There was nobody after Barry? We'd have to check that.
I'd say
Posey.
Posey
didn't have 20?
No, Posey never hit 20.
He just had a couple years driving over 100?
Yeah.
Dang. Oh, hey, it just shows you don't need a 20 home run hitter on your team to win a World Series.
After the steroid era, no, you don't. All right, we're going to end the segment on that today. I just wanted to wish you all very happy holidays.
Thanks for having me on.
Of course. Thank you, Sewanee, for coming and be here. This is my last episode. I hope all you enjoyed, and I will catch you around.